the business is changing at an exponential rate. And if you're like me, there are far more questions to get answers to than you have time in the day. Each week, I sit down with a unique guest and get their perspective on something interesting in business. It could be something I'm trying to learn, a topic we're seeing happen in the world. It could be demand gen, artificial intelligence, go-to-market, strategy, branding. I get curious, and I'll go lots of places. I hope you enjoy listening to these conversations as much as I enjoy having them. Before we get started with today's guest, please make sure you like and subscribe. Now, on to the show. Welcome back to The Summit. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer. I'm very excited for today's topic. Today, we're going to talk about psychology and marketing, and I've got a very special guest, a fractional CMO, board member, kind of a data geek, and overall, I don't know, maybe serial entrepreneur. If you look at her LinkedIn profile, you'll see that she's doing a lot, interested in a lot, and never afraid of learning. Yeah. So today's guest is Elza Malik. Elza, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh my gosh. For those of you who are listening in, last week, Elza and I got together to just kind of have a pre-show chat. We talked about all kinds of things. The conversation was absolutely fascinating. So I'm very, very excited for today's chat. But before we get into the topic, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do. I mean, I kind of put the synopsis together, but that's just barely the headline. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
So I do two core things in addition to being a board member and an advisor and so on. And that is being a fractional CMO, where I use psychology-based marketing for go-to-market strategies and really getting organizations from that zero to one, like that next level of sophistication in their marketing strategies. And then I own a psychology-based marketing firm that is truly in the business of changing hearts and minds for organizations, because everybody buys emotionally and then they confirmation bias themselves into thinking they bought a lot from a logical perspective. And it's really tapping into those emotions and capitalizing on them.
That, you know, you speak of that, and as you talk about the buyer's behavior, buying emotionally and then justifying it logically, as somebody who started in sales and has now moved into the marketing side of things, I find that to be very, very true in the buying process, specifically when I'm selling consumer to consumer. But before we start talking about how it gets applied to business strategy and the other pieces, what are the principles of psychologically based marketing and helping understand or the framework of what your business does and help your customers be successful?
So the framework is something that I think every organization, at least at the heart of it, understands. Like, marketing inherently has psychological elements. And what we did 5 years ago was we said, okay, we were more in the marketing science data world. I come from a data science background, and we just got tired of people asking us to build attribution models, because the whole point was really understanding what the customer is doing and why they're doing it, versus building data platforms. And that was where the light bulb came in. It's like the data isn't for understanding, the data is for comfort. And digging deeper into that, even within my own clients, I'm like, why are they doing that? I went into this way, and our model is called the butterfly effect, where it creates this string theory approach that takes into consideration the psychological profile of the brand and the culture, the psychological profile of the audience that they're going after, the different types of profiles, as well as the emotional journey that they have to go into. We talk about buyer journey a lot in our approach, and I think that the biggest difference is we know what emotion needs to go into each stage in order for there to be kind of a critical mass, and then you can easily move into the next one. And that story process is really critical when I'm a human and I may be subconsciously thinking about things that the forefront of my brain isn't, and playing to those modes. So our approach is really in that wavelength of thought. And I think there's a few others out there. And there are three key elements that I see when you have a really good psychology-based program or marketing program. And that is the ethical components is kind of the first and foremost. Our information is backed by institutions and universities, but we have to sign codes of conduct and ethical guidelines into the process to make sure we don't abuse this information. I think that's a really critical component. It is kind of starting from a place of compassion around, I really genuinely want to understand what's going on in the marketplace, as opposed to, I just want to shove something down people's throat. And I think that's a really big aspect of it, because marketing can be manipulative and it can have the other aspects. And what's interesting is that may have a little bit of success, and then you reach the perception landing, is what we call it. And then you go on the other side, and now you've damaged your brand more than you've helped it. And it's much more expensive and harder to fix that once you've gone through it. And the third one is really around understanding your brand from an emotional standpoint. We look at that. How does your organization actually operate internally, and what does that mean externally?
You know, you talk about these principles, and I think a lot of it's been around, and I know at least for the advertising industry, they use this a lot in CPG, right? Consumer product goods, making sure that they're ethical in how they present their ads, not over-promising or under-delivering, you know, even to the point where I think we don't have as many cigarette or smoking ads or different things that we used to have based on, you know, some of the psychological impact. As you're talking about it, I hear threads of B2B. You know, you're talking about attribution models. You're talking about, it almost sounds like you're taking what organizations are doing today as they go to market in a business to business manner and turning it into a human to human interaction. Is that a decent way to summarize?
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize it, because I come from the B2B world, but my client set is mixed. It's almost 50-50. At this point, I come from life sciences and big tech. So the world there is very, very analytical, very specific. And I think it's a lot of analytical brains trying to put in a system or a process that is repeatable, but humans are very unpredictable. So tapping into that level of, well, this is why the data is showing this way, is really critical when you think about it. And because you're right, the advertising space and even some of the branding that was done from the 50s until like the 80s was very psychologically based. The difference for a lot of those is you had a little research, it was translated into a way, and then it's been diluted or it's been desensitized into the marketplace. So some of those things don't work today, which is why continuous research is really, really critical.
I'd be willing to bet Bud Light is in a spot where, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, the psychological impact of running that one ad, that one social media little campaign, and then the backlash that took them from being the number one domestic beer for 20 years. And I think it was just this week that they've been now dropped to number two. You know, I think getting the psychology of understanding your buyer and your market right, as well as managing it against where you want to go as a brand and the way you want to embrace culture, the future, you know, in the broader market, that can be really tricky. Talk about some of the challenges brands face, because you said, you know, how your brand operates and what it looks like. How does good psychology, ethical psychology, and meeting your customers in a human to human way manifest itself inside of a B2B company?
I think the critical area there is really understanding the first and foremost, like when you're talking about yourself, being very transparent. Every organization has good things. Every organization has bad things. Every organization has some messy things. And just saying like, this is us, we're, you know, just like a human, we're kind of imperfect and we own that. And owning that is a really critical step in that authenticity phase that when we do like a brand audit or what have you, in order to go through it. And if you're a B2B company, and you want to potentially evolve yourself in the next 5 years, you have to kind of know where you are. Just like, you know, whenever you do forecasting or any type of other analysis, you got to look at current state and look at it at a very transparent phase of saying, here's where culture is. We have these kind of problems. And then you take that identity to say, okay, well, culture is very, it could be very open. There is someone I was talking to a few days ago. They have a very transparent culture. but sometimes it's to a fault where they go through these ebbs and flows of energy because they're very transparent. And now the goal is to say, how do we manage the emotional cycle? Because you want to keep that transparency, but you don't necessarily want to freak people out every time something comes out, and keeping that steadiness, so to speak, throughout it. Once you have that aspect of internal who we are inside, then you say, okay, well, how do we want to be perceived? That is the most closest level to truth, to who we are. And that's a lot of shifting and manipulating. I think I look at it like clay. You're forming something that is still inherently clay. You're just changing its shape into something that you want to see, which has a level of beauty, a level of authenticity, and a level of appreciation that we want to make sure we go through. Because if there's anything that we've learned in the last 3 years is if your people don't buy your brand message, no one else is going to.
If you're listening, let that sink in. If your people don't buy your brand message, nobody else is going to. That's a big impact statement. Some of my own personal self-discovery on brand and trying to understand it, because as a sales guy turned marketer, when, you know, I started moving into the marketing world and everybody was talking about brand, branding, colors, you know, messaging, positioning, and brand narrative, I kept going, that doesn't matter. Brand is perception. Like, it's how the organization behaves, and then it's how it's perceived in the market. So, you know, what are you spending all this time on colors and words and these pieces? And then I read the book Onward, and Howard Schultz and what Starbucks did by setting the mission to make the Starbucks brand the third place, the place between home and work, where you could have a community, have some place to consist. And this was this third place, right? There's this other home. And then they looked at how that made them change all of their operations, how they sourced their material, their coffee, all of the different things, how they paid their employees. It did change the perception, because the perception started internal and then manifested itself external. And for me, that's a really tangible example, because when I first started getting Starbucks, they were just a coffee shop inside of a Barnes and Noble. And as they really started expanding and setting up their own stores, it became a place to go work. It became a place to go meet with friends. It became a hangout. It became a place to go where I was like, well, I don't have to go to the beer and go to a bar and deal with really loud music. I can just go to the coffee shop and have a quiet conversation. I can just go to Starbucks. Mm-hmm. For a B2B brand, what are things that you think they could do, or things you've seen be successful, where they can take the data, the insights, whether it's qualitative or quantitative, get that feedback and start to transform their experiences? What does that look like beyond just words on a manifesto or transparency in your monthly standups? What does that really start to look like?
So that's a really good question, because every B2B has slightly different identities, and the identity is actually critical to the way that you're going to showcase that identity. So you look at large organizations like Microsoft or what have you, they have such a consumer level of exposure that they have to do both. But for the average B2B brand that is, you know, in that space of really building relationships, maybe you could have anywhere between small deal sizes to massive deal sizes. The critical area there is, like, take back to say, where do we showcase best? Is that in digital formats? Is that in in-person experiences? And start there, because you never want to start with the hardest one, I will say. So if your team has a very well-rounded sales team that's great at communicating and building bonds and showcasing what the brand really is, lean into more in-person experiences and opportunities that lean into it. If you struggle with that, because there is a psychological way of, like, creating an event space and doing event design and hosting events that capitalizes all of that and then still uses marketing. If your mode is, well, we are a digital first, remote only kind of environment, then you kind of have to think about where those are. Do I communicate through podcasting or what have you? You have to really take those channels And then there are some obscure channels where you can still do the same mode of marketing. You can still do SEO. You can still do advertising or what have you. But the way you do it, the amount of effort you put into creative, the type of musics you select, all those little things play into the remnants bump of the brain. And the one thing that I think if any B2B organization is kind of listening to this is when we think about the buyer journey, our process has like a subconscious stage before you even get into awareness. And studies show that you need to have 75 to 100 touch points that are not recognized by the buyer, at least on the forefront of their brain, the conscious part of the brain, but are seen and absorbed in the back part of their brain. And it's almost like a puzzle being put together. It's like, okay, I've had one touch point, putting one puzzle piece. I have another one. And that's how it goes too. Once that puzzle is formed, then you move into awareness. And that's when the 7 to 9 touch points before they remember you and have the right emotion occurs. And that's why I think branding is really, really important when you're a B2B, because you want to make sure that someone has at least half a picture put together before they're being introduced to your brand. And it's the right emotion before they have a negative reaction. And now they already have a certain bias in their head about who you are.
You know, that 75 to 100 is alarming, and it's alarming for a couple of reasons. The majority of companies that I work with are in the SaaS space. They're looking at first touch or last touch attribution models. They want a one-to-one relationship between what did I do and what converted. And you're talking about hundreds of tiny interactions, activities before I even get to a spot where I could be influenced by any sort of first touch or last touch attribution model. With where we are with AI, and the very rapid adoption of it in marketing departments and organizations, specifically B2B, looking for, oh, I can make my teams more efficient. Maybe I can not hire that freelancer and just use ChatGPT, or, you know, looking for different ways to leverage technology. Do you see risks in brand erosion, in psychological warfare, losing impact or even authenticity by leaning too far into AI or getting too far away in the creative? And then how should organizations start to think about or manage that? Like, what do you think about those things?
This is such a really good question, because I think every organization is going through what should I be using ChatGPT for and what should I keep as a human element. And I will have to say this is a purely a prediction, but this happened when the digital space really boomed. The reason why we have that 75 to 100 touch points is because most of them are digital. So, and you think about the shelf life of digital, it's much shorter. So the puzzle pieces get smaller and smaller when there's more touch points. I think ChatGPT is going to offer an opportunity for equalizing smaller brands for the opportunity to just get a little bit better than where they were today, put some content out. But if you're an organization that's a little bit more established, I would be really careful, because you just spent all this time and effort and money and resources to build the brand the way you are. And ChatGPT is much more of a generalist than a specialist. And when you're in that phase, you definitely need a little bit more specialty in your space. And that's where content writers who can use the right word choice and invoke the right emotion is really, really critical. ChatGPT is I'm still waiting for like it to get to like second grade mode. I think it's a toddler mode where it's dangerous enough to reach the kitchen stove, but not enough to know that it's hot, so to speak. And that's where I'm kind of waiting for that phase of being able to train it a little bit more. But I would be very cautious in that end where you're only using ChatGPT as your source of content development or any of these AI models, because it will slowly start to degrade who you see yourself as and how you present yourself. And now you're all of a sudden this very general company, because AI only knows as much data as it's given. And then it creates the mean of that information and then spits it up for you, versus saying, here's who I am. I am Coca-Cola, for example, because we all know Coca-Cola. This is what I stand for. This is what I live and breathe by. The AI doesn't have that level of focus, at least not today, or with products that we've seen. in testing. So that's where I would be really cautious of outlining, structuring, removing nuanced tasks. I'm loving AI for those things. Writing a very personalized message about a particular case study, even, which is very fact-based. Not so much, because it's missing the aspects of what truly happened in the story and where was the emotional change in that narrative, that it still can't really figure out, even with having engineers as prompt writers and what have you. It doesn't get it because it doesn't know you.
So I think about in the context of B2B, in the context of a brand, in the context of looking at it for, you know, what could you use AI or not use AI for? Several years ago, there was an organization that I was working with that was consolidating 8 brands into a singular new brand into the market. While they were doing that, they were launching a new SaaS platform, and the industry that they were in was, I wouldn't say tech adverse, but they were slow adoption, right? So there's still plenty of green space in this industry for tech adoption. And as we went through the rebrand or their centralization brand, the umbrella brand, as we went through all of the brand strategy work, we really had 4 core elements of what was it that mattered about who we were that we wanted the market to see? And then why would they believe us? And then that turned into, I'll call it a launch campaign or a national advertising campaign focused on, I can't say it any other way else other than being a one place for contractors to go before they built. So it's like, here's everything you need before you put a shovel or oh man, my son's going to kill me. This is his favorite. It's his favorite caterpillar machine. I can't think of this as a scoop bucket, but I know that's not the right. That's not the excavator before we put an excavator in the ground. But I look at AI and I could spend hours writing prompts and talking to AI. We wouldn't have been able to get to that level of assert without the human element. How much of the human element before it gets to AI in your brand has to be leaning into creativity, leaning into your special sauce and being a reflection of, for a lot of businesses, their leadership. I mean, I know it's really should be your whole company, but if the leaders don't buy in, if they're not thinking creatively, is it really ever going to manifest itself in an impactful way in the market?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there has to be a balance between what you want to automate and what you want to productize and really optimize in your organization and what you still hold to your core values and how you communicate that. And the way that I've seen it, at least for now, the most successful is creative is very heavy in the beginning. And bringing those ideas, when we think about creatives and their personality type, they love kind of jotting things down, organizing them, and kind of putting them at least in brainstorm sessions. So I think that is a very critical space where integrity must be maintained in a human-to-human standpoint. You may have ChatGPT on your laptop or something if you're brainstorming with several other people and saying, like, let me just ask this question and get us moving faster, so that way you don't have to wait and put it as a pin for review later. So that has helped a lot, but the actual idea generation comes from humans first. And then in the organizing phase, ChatGPT is really good at putting everything like in an outline or sorted or what have you, because it's a lot of nuanced information. Like, here's the data dump, sort it for me so that way it's digestible and shareable to different types of personalities and different types of learners. And I think that's really critical into getting executive buy-in, because you could take the several whiteboards and whatever else we've documented in a creative session, for lack of a better word, translating it into corporate speak for executives. And that's a really good way for at least our team to get buy-in, to say, here's a really interesting idea in order to generate the emotional response. Here's what it means for the business, and here's the business speak. So that ChatGPT helped generate, and here's some of the outlines or layouts, so that way you get a sneak peek of what we're planning versus potentially planning an entire brand activation from start to finish and then realizing you didn't get executive buy-in into the space because there's no budget or whatever for it. That's a really good way to do it. But it comes from the fact that the executives and the leadership team really have to be open to going more. As I mentioned, AI is a great equalizer, but it's also a great like mean spitter, so to speak. It only gives you the average of what it knows because it's a calculation in its space. So if you only spit out the average, which is what ChatGPT is giving you, and so are 15 other brands that are in your competitive space, then you all look the same. So why is the buyer going to care about you versus somebody else?
You know, it's interesting because I think, and not to make this about ChatGPT, because I still think this gets into the psychology of marketing, but as you even asked that question, you know, how do you stand out? It actually begs the question to me, back to your first point, the ethical or moral way in which you leverage psychological marketing in how you reach the humans on the other end, not to abuse it. What are the impacts in how you're structuring and organizing? What are the gotchas? What are the holes? You know, we're seeing GA4 come over as Google and browsers, and people are moving towards getting away from the cookie and trying to make data more private. We've now got ChatGPT where we're feeding it all of our words and information, and it's storing it and building it in its models. Like, how does principle number one get applied for an organization today trying to do ethical marketing and still use psychology as a backbone for reaching their audience?
Yeah, so I think that in order for ethical marketing to occur, you really need to figure out like what the guidelines for it are. And in our, space, the ones that we've come up with have some really big tenets, and then a few other kind of compliance pieces that we've baked into our technology so we don't have to worry about it, so to speak. But the first few are definitely behavioral. Of how humans behave. And a lot of it is, a lot of stuff, especially in B2B world, is very confidential. So feeding ChatGPT a very highly confidential aspect of your business, I would be very cautious about that, because we don't know. We may have an idea of how information is being used about it today, but we don't know how it's going to be used tomorrow. That's why we had the Facebook Cambridge Analytica issue years ago. We didn't know that's how it was being used until after the fact. So that's one thing that I would be cautious around. And the way that we came up with ours, just to give some folks idea, bring a few people from your team, whether technical or not, and talk about AI and talk about your audience and talk about the things that audience would feel is obtrusive and things that you would potentially want to hide, and list those out and say, those are the things that we won't feed into ChatGPT. Because I think that that's a really critical aspect. If there's something that you necessarily have to say, you can't tell people that we use ChatGPT for that. You probably shouldn't be using it in the first place because it might break some kind of ethical code that you inherently know about the organization, even if it's not on paper. That we kind of go through. That's an exercise that we did. We said, what data should we never feed into ChatGPT? And that's part of our ethical guidelines in the process. Then you go into, well, what data can we feed into ChatGPT or some kind of AI model? We really shouldn't, because it will, based on practice or history, it doesn't really meet the emotional state that we're trying to get out of it when we go back into psychology marketing. And then we start to shift it into, okay, what data should we feed into ChatGPT because it makes us better or it makes us truer to who we are? And those are the three quadrants that we baked our guidelines into. Our code of conduct is much more, at least for the external buyer or people that we communicate externally with, it's much shorter, but the internal, when we bring people on, there's a part of the code of conduct that we kind of go through, and AI is the new chapter that we've added into it around things that we can and can't, and there is an audit honor system in some cases, and then there's audits and what have you, just kind of make sure we're all compliant in the way that we go through it. But it should be a combination of marketing and really those in people operations or human resources to co-create along with a CEO or president to say, this is what we really need to do. And that has to be updated. Like, we already updated ours from 2 weeks ago because Firefly released something that was much more accessible. And we said, okay, we need to take into consideration more image generated content and what have you. So it's a balance, and it's not going to be easy, but I found it very rewarding because now my team has a line, right? Like, here's the line that we don't cross when it comes to AI, because we either don't know enough about it, and we have some teams that cross it intentionally in very isolated spaces because they're testing to say, with this new piece of technology, has the line shifted? Should we go back? Should we go forward? And work through it.
You know, it's interesting to think about that and just absorb what you're talking about as it relates to code of conduct, you know, inputs, outputs, et cetera. It reminds me a little bit of the work that needed to be done for the GDPR several years ago in your supplier, your distributor, you know, the people where the data was owned, how you deleted it, et cetera. But more than that, I think that how these tools and psychological marketing are leveraged impact your business strategy, predominantly because data is the new oil. And yeah, as everybody looks at data as the new oil, this is, okay, well, what's my secret sauce? Because just because I have access to a lot of data, just because I have access to the ability to leverage tools to do really interesting and unique things, if I put all of that in an environment where everybody has access to it, now I just become, to your point earlier, right? If I'm average, and then I got average in and I get average out, then I'm not really going to stand out. When you think about business strategy, psychological marketing, go to market, and then, you know, leveraging tools, how should business owners, CEOs, go to market teams be looking at and thinking about protecting their IP while still creating a data-led or a data-informed or a data-guided experience for making decisions? Because it feels to me a lot like, well, I'll just take and I'll ask a question to ChatGPT. Here's my last four quarters of QBRs. What is that was working? Tell us what we should do. And then the board comes back and says, go do that. That feels to me like we could see that happen, but that's really risky. So what should business strategy, how should it be informed? How should we think about this differently?
So I will kind of take a step back and say, before you even get to forming a business strategy, have the opportunity to look back into who your brand is and who your audience is. And if you have the tools to do some type of psychological analysis, that should inform a good portion of your business strategy. Because as you just mentioned, I could put in my data into some kind of AI model, and I could say, tell me what you think worked. But I can almost guarantee you, if you ask that AI model the same question in a different user, or even just say regenerate response, it's going to give you a different answer. Right? That's why we have the positive, negative, what have you aspect to it, because it just says, this is what I see. And what's interesting about perception management in data, and this is one of the things that we do, and going back to our marketing intelligence days that we added the layer of psychology, is I can look at a set of data and I could see one thing. You could look at a set of data and you could see an entirely different thing. Somebody else could, and they could. So we have three different stories of the same data, the same dashboard even, right? And that's what ChatGPT does. And that's where it gets so risky, is it's taking like a shot in the dark because it doesn't know what you're actually looking for. You're just asking a very general question. And even if you get really hyper-specific of, tell me what is the, what converted the best or what have you, that is not truly objective, like what quarter did the best, and it has numerical calculations to show you what quarter did the best. It's only pulling from its, the average of its data. And if I'm an organization that is planning the rest of my 2023 and into 2024, and I'm using ChatGPT for business strategy, and I'm not taking into consideration who I am as a brand, where my audience is, and where I think they're going to go and what their behavior is going to be, then my business strategy, at least from a go-to-market perspective, is very skewed. It's going to be the same as 15 other people who are in the same space as you. And now your audience is like, well, why would I choose you? If you think about how you buy, and this is where I encourage everyone to kind of look at, to say, if I'm a CEO and I run a $200 million B2B company, and I'm looking toward 2024, what am I feeling right now? Don't even ask what they're facing. What am I feeling right now? And then start from there. If that's your target audience or whoever, what am I feeling today? And then you go into, well, why am I feeling those things? What pressures are giving me the negative feelings? What positives are giving me the exciting feelings, the happy feelings? And work your way backward, because that will tell you way more than ChatGPT will. And it's less about, when it comes to business strategy, I always say, I'm like, it's less about speed and more about thought. Most people that I know that write really, really, really detailed and well thought out business strategies of where they're going to go, and honestly, sometimes the most successful ones are the ones where there's about 80% of thinking and 20% of writing. Because you want to marinate through ideas, you want to think through them. You can jot them down, you can go through them, but you're not going to put pen to paper and say, this is my business strategy and it's final. It should be a continuous, ever-flowing aspect. And there's a value to the pivot. We have a friend's joke because of the couch pivot scenario that we kind of go through, and we look at data. I'm like, it's time to pivot, because we've given it enough maturation. And sometimes the pivots are big enough that we have to switch our business strategy to it, because the market is changing every day. And something that was not even in the forethought of our brain a year ago, when maybe we came up with this business strategy for the second half of 2023, is now there. And it's still part of our 3 to 5 year plan, but it's just going to be executed a little bit differently than we laid it out. So if you think about, you know, where I am, if I'm your target audience and what I'm experiencing, and then where the brand is and what their authentic truth is, work your way backward. And that's why I kind of look at sales and marketing as the tip of the spear. And right when you get to the larger set of the sphere, that's where the business strategy comes in, because you almost need to know who your audience is, what your brand truth is. Just need to do a deeper analysis before you get into that other half of the era or sphere.
You talked about doing some psychological profiling, whether it's, again, not a business, but of the individuals, and whether it's qualitative or quantitative. What does that look like? How does it manifest itself as insights that can inform the business strategy, that can inform and influence the brand? What, you know, as you talk about that, what are the elements there that really give you true insight?
So we, at least our internal team, and the way that I've kind of always conducted it, and I'm a big storyteller, I love reading. I look at it as, if you were going to write a book about this character, let's see what they would actually do. Let's do a lot of character development. And we all know that when you're writing personas, it's great when you add their name and tie a face to it and what have you. Go a little bit deeper. Like, what is on average they probably experienced in their life for this type of personality or profile? And I'll sit here, and one of my clients, they sell to scientists. So, and particularly they sell to chemists, and a lot of them are in academia. So we sit there and it's like, well, who are they? Well, chances are they are the generation where STEM and women in research was a very heavy push by the public sector. So the chances of them leaning women is actually almost 80-20 in that space. And because they experienced that particular set of experiences and communication and messages when they were younger, which, by the way, is where you form most of your biases in the world between ages 10, like 8 to 10 to 16, 18 is where almost all of your biases get formed. The others are reinforcers of those originals. So now you have those that have been communicated to go into science, go into these spaces. And we actually, when we create a profile to say, how did that impact their day-to-day world? And how they operate today. When they look at things, do they look at it from a sense of pride, or do they look at it from a sense of entitlement? And go through it and walk yourself through what that person may have experienced. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time when you have to go down memory lane and historical things that have happened, but that's part of the research. And when you know that, you can make references to that phase of their life that they probably hold near and dear because it's shaped who they are so critically in at least a third of their life that they spend today. And then you pull that emotion, you pull that nostalgia into the conversation, and now you've closed all these deals because you pulled into that emotional state. You've pulled into something that historically has influenced a large part of their life. So we walk through that character development really, really thoughtfully. And we said, what would this person's adolescent life look like? And we, again, it's all in generalization. If someone were to profile me, they would probably be really wrong because I'm an immigrant in the United States. So I have a very different perspective of where that comes from. But so I have like no 90s references if someone makes them, unless I've been assimilated by friends and family through that process. But those generalizations really do help because it pulls into the similar vein of if someone were to make a friend's joke, which I wasn't here for the majority of that show, but I have friends obviously that are there, and they culminate and you come into that activity. So it still works for me, even though I was not there during the time, because my memory is fun time with friends while I'm watching Friends versus actually being in the experience. Think about those things as you're kind of going through it. It's like, what journey would they have been on to create those moments and those key differentiators in their process?
Well, that reminds me a lot of scientific advertising, but more importantly, the first book I ever read was written by a guy by the name of Rich Harshaw. And he said, if you want to know what John Smith buys, see the world through John Smith's eyes. And it you're really talking about, it's not just what they're thinking about in this moment. It's the sum total of their experiences and their whole entire life, seeing the world through their own bias, their own perspective. And I think that level of deep thinking, at least in my experience, in campaigns that our teams have done, when we've done that level of deep work, it has had tremendous impact on the advertising, on the campaigns, on the actual effectiveness of what we were doing in conversion and, in pipeline and growth and sales. And so it's, to me, it's almost, it seems like a no-brainer, and yet it's not something many companies do.
No. And I think it's because it's a much longer process for sure. It requires a level of forethought and planning that I think marketing sometimes is struggles to do when there's so much coming at them. So we have like a stoic process for marketing where we have high payoff activities where we complete really quickly. And those are outside of our stoic phase. And then we have the ones where we're going to like sit and do our due diligence and think about it. Because I think the part that a lot of marketing teams face is they create this beautiful campaign. Maybe they went through that entire process, and by the time they're getting launched, we have 15 other ideas coming down the pike to say we should do this, this, and this. And that's really hard to manage. It's a constant, I think, struggle that a lot of marketing teams face, where everyone is coming at them with ideas because they're seeing things that are coming out from the consumer world that resonate with that particular person who's giving the advice, but doesn't necessarily resonate with the audience that they're going after. And that's where I always say, and I love it when a CEO comes to me and says, I hate our new ad. I'm like, good, because you're not our target audience.
Yeah.
If you were, I would be really worried, because then we totally missed the boat for it. If we're making some, early 2000s, some Disney related thematic or nostalgia pull for people that we're selling to in Gen Z, that's what it's going to sound like. It's going to be a little bit cheesy. It's going to be a little bit quirky because at the time, ABC was able to pull, like, get away with a little bit more. So those are the things that we can use. And if you don't understand the reference, that's even better, because now then we've hit the right audience at the right time within the things that they've experienced, and you just don't happen to be one of them. You can appreciate something that you don't relate to. And that's something I try to teach my team and everyone around me, of like, there's beauty in things that you don't understand. It's being open enough to be empathetic to understand their situation.
And curious enough to ask why is that, and trying to understand, right?
Yeah.
Elza, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, have more conversations, understand psychological marketing at a deeper level, where can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
LinkedIn's the easiest. If you have questions or what have you that you want to just say, hey, I've got a weird question. I love those. That's probably the easiest, and it's just my first last name as a handle. Go to my website, bluemonarchgroup.com, as a pillar if you want to learn more about psychology marketing, or if you just want to poke and prod into some white papers and case studies that we've written, just to get an idea of like, how do I actually do these things? But yeah, those are probably the two fastest ones.
That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sharing us with us a little bit about you, about what you do, helping pull back some of the layers of the onion for psychological marketing, and how B2B companies can really create an H2H experience, human to human interaction.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've loved this conversation.
It's been a blast. Until next week, like, follow, subscribe. Throw your phone in the trash if you hated it. Doesn't really matter. We'll be back next week with a fun episode on some new topic that I find interesting. Until then, we'll speak soon.